Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program and Latin American Studies Program. Speaking will be Dr. Ben Vinson, Director of the Center for Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Vinson's lecture is titled, Caste in Mexico. We begin with an introduction by Professor Linda Haywood, Director of the African American Studies Program.
It is my honor to welcome a friend and colleague, Dr. Ben Vinson, Director of Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Vinson is a historian of Latin American studies with a particular interest in race relations, especially the experience of the African diaspora. While his research focuses on colonial Mexico, he has a broader range of interests that include the 19th and 20th centuries. Dr. Vinson's research interests also include transnational networks, including the experiences between African Americans and Latinos, as well as Afro-Latinos. Dr. Vinson is a prolific scholar and has written a number of articles and books, including Bearing Arms for His Majesty, the Free Colored Militia in Colonial Mexico, which I use in my class, very, very interesting book, and Flight, the Story of Virgil Richardson, a Tuskegee Airman in Mexico, also Afro-Mexico. His forthcoming work is on the experiences of Afro-Mexicans in North Carolina. His current book-length project involves an assessment of the Mexican colonial caste system, particularly the experiences which he refers to as the forgotten caste, Lobos, Moriscos, Coyotes, and Chinos. Dr. Vinson is also working on a second edition of Herbert Klein's African Slavery in Latin America and the Caribbean. Dr. Vinson teaches a wide range of courses on the Latin American colonial experience, family social history, the African diaspora, and race relations in Latin America. Dr. Vinson received his AB degree from Dartmouth College and his PhD degree from my alma mater, Columbia University. Prior to joining the Johns Hopkins faculty, Dr. Vinson taught at Barnard College and Penn State University. Dr. Vinson has also held a number of fellowships, including Fulbright, National Humanities Center, the Social Science Research Center, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Mellon Foundation. Dr. Vinson's presentation today is entitled Caste in Mexico, and here we have him. Thanks very much for coming.
Thank you so much for that fine introduction. I really appreciate it. I almost can't even recognize myself after hearing that. The topic of my presentation today, caste in Mexico, is actually somewhat misleading because what I will be talking about actually extends well beyond Mexico to discuss some of the interrelationships between the United States and its southern neighbor. I'm hoping to do today is to kind of blend some of my current research with some of my previous research, as well as some speculations that I've been having over the past couple of years in this new position that I'm occupying as Director of Center for Africana Studies. In particular, there have been a number of concerns that I've had recently regarding the shape of race relations and the task of achieving goals of diversity in a world that is actually rapidly undergoing tremendous demographic change. Now, given the centrality of Mexico to our current national debates over immigration, I believe that a close examination of the development of relations between the United States and Mexico is wholly warranted at this time. But I believe that apart from the usual debates that we have over citizenship status, educational access, labor policies, and the like, there are actually deeper conceptual issues at stake for both countries in our evolving relations. Conceptual issues that have resonance with the articulation and the formulation of our social and racial structures. Public comments that were made in the spring of 2005 by former Mexican President Vicente Fox about how Mexican immigrants in the United States are performing jobs that not even blacks want to do, combined with the public debates that took place that summer on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border, about the comic book character Mimin Pinguin and how he may be revealing of racist attitudes in Mexican society are important signal events that I think are revealing of a new chapter in American-Mexican relations. Mimin Pinguin is a young boy who grows up in Mexico City in one of the working class barrios, neighborhoods of Mexico City. And the comic book depicts Mimin very much like a little Sambo figure with the big plate eyes, the oversized watermelon lips, the butt of all jokes. He's the butt of all jokes in this comic book in that he interacts with the cross-section of Mexican society. And he's bumbling. His Spanish is barely intelligible. He is, again, like I said, he's the humor of the comic book. But yet, at the same time, he's the most loyal figure. He loves Mexico like no other. It's remarkable through the series of this comic book, which was actually created in 1949 and still can be found on the streets of Mexico today, how he takes these remarkable trips. He comes to the United States, he goes to Africa, and through it all, he remains intensely loyal to Mexico. The creator of the comic book, Yolanda Vargas, who has since passed away, became rich off Mimin Pinguin and created the comic actually from a trip after she had taken a trip to Cuba and had a boyfriend named Guillermo. So Mimin is supposed to be, in some ways, a corruption of that name, Guillermo, a nickname of sorts. Pinguin has many, many connotations, some of which are quite phallic. It's just a kind of a play on words in this character, and also a play on social status in his life. So what was the debate all about? 2005, the artist of this comic book, a guy named Sixto Valencia, who I had the chance to interview, and he didn't know I was actually African-American before that interview, and it was shocking, his reaction, when we actually came. I actually came with my cousin and my mom to interview him in Mexico City. His reaction was, he didn't even look up at us as he was answering questions. It was remarkable. When we were asking him questions about, you know, why do you draw this? Why these images? La, la, la. In any case, the comic book was memorialized because it was such an important comic in Mexican history and in Mexican national identity. It was part of the literacy campaigns that were launched in Mexico. People actually learned to read by reading Mimin Pinguin. It's fascinating, quite fascinating. So a stamp was commemorated in 2005, and all heck broke loose on our side of the border. And Mexico, quite frankly, couldn't understand what the hullabaloo was all about. I argue that it's also because there's a bank of images, a storehouse of images in the Mexican imaginary of blackness. Mimin Pinguin is just one of many. What's interesting is that these particular images are circulating in the vocabulary of the Mexican social imaginary. And so Mimin Pinguin is nothing strange when kind of juxtaposed against the menu and recipe of images that exist. And in fact, this newspaper article that ran in February 13th, this past February, kind of shows you the play of these images in society on a daily basis. This is the daily newspaper La Jornada, one of Mexico's most liberal papers. And what we see here is a reinterpretation of Barack Obama a la through the images that exist in the repository of the Mexican imaginary. So we see Barack Pinguin here, I'm not going to read everything here, but basically he's the hero of the neighborhood. He is the everyman. And so how do you translate that? Because of his color, how you recode it through the Mimin Pinguin figure. And it's nothing complex, nothing problematic, I argued for you, in the Mexican case. But for us, looking at it across the border, it becomes a little bit problematic. And something else, I think Will Smith has an incredible influence in Mexico and has an incredible influence in the production of blackness in Mexico. And I won't get too much into this because that's not the focus of this talk. But what you see is the kind of the recycling of Will Smith through Barack Obama through Will Smith. And in this bottom image outtake here, he and Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are the Men in Black. For those of you who might remember that movie, so they are the protectors of the imperial capitalist order of the United States represents. And up top, We see San Martin de Porras, a very famous saint that is seen in many households throughout Mexico, and the reincarnation of Barak here. So I'm just kind of showing you the images that circulate and create the vocabulary that is an interesting one in Mexico. I believe that in this current environment of globalization, of transnationalism, of neoliberal and post-neoliberal politics, the shape of American-Mexican relations is quickly changing. As more Mexicans come into the United States and as more Americans travel and learn about Mexico, I think that our two cultures and our social structures are becoming ever more linked. As our social and cultural histories continue to converge in the 21st century, we will have to engage in new debates about our societies. Both countries will be forced to rethink our interpretations of race. On our side of the border, for instance, rapid immigration, which has seen more than 30 million people enter the United States since 1965, has caused us to rethink some of the staid categories of race and ethnicity that have traditionally functioned in America. Now, if the U.S. Census is a good barometer of change, the formal inclusion of Hispanics as an ethnic category in the 1970 census, and I use Hispanics because that's the vocabulary that's used in the census, is suggestive of the correlation between the demographic effects of immigration and considerations of diversity. Furthermore, in Census 2000, our most recent census, the formal incorporation of Latinos and the complex matrix of nationalities and races, which were allowed for in the census, right now, actually in the United States, we have over 60 different racial and ethnic compositions that are possible. It's remarkable. I mean, it actually echoes something that we'll be getting into later. It actually echoes the Mexican caste system, the caste systems with their multiplicity of racial types and racial possibilities. But we have that here, thanks to Census 2000. So with that, our ideas of race and ethnicity are being stretched, at least from the government's perspective. Today, we are far from the traditional black-white binary of yesteryear, and even well beyond a black, white, red, Asian racial quadrangle. The new millennium, as seen in the census, allows for interwoven configurations of racial and ethnic pluralism that our forefathers would have never imagined, and quite frankly, which I think they probably would have rolled over in their graves if they realized where we are today. Now, meanwhile, let's flip to Mexico. In Mexico, at the dawn of the 21st century, immigration, combined with particular international and domestic events, have compelled reassessments of attitudes towards race and ethnicity. The outbreak of hostilities in Chiapas, a war that's still simmering, that outbreak happened in the 1990s, and the wide-ranging international support that the rebels received, combined with a Latin America-wide push for rights from indigenous and Afro-Latin American-based groups, through support from multilateral organizations and non-governmental organizations, all of this pressure has caused the Mexican state to pay closer attention to issues of multiculturalism and racially plural politics. Moreover, the attitudes and international experiences that immigrants from Mexico have brought back home through their transnational networks, especially those immigrants who have traveled to the United States, their experiences abroad have created new understandings of race, racial politics, and even discrimination. New anti-discrimination campaigns in Mexico, for instance, have started to appear. And some limited efforts have even been made towards including information about blacks and other races and ethnicities in the Mexican school curriculum. There are a few lines now about Afro-Mexicans in Mexican textbooks. Marvelous, remarkable. There is even a national-level advisory board that is run by a Congolese expatriate that supervises Mexico's policies of racial toleration. So there's actually a board now where if you have a case of discrimination, you can take it to this individual and to this assembly. Although I've been told that there's not a single case of discrimination has yet been reported, which is interesting because although these structures exist, the actual rewiring of the mentality to even see discrimination is something that has not quite yet met with where we are in terms of where Mexico is with its governmental structures. And I'm not so sure that Mexico actually wants a case tried. But in any case, that's for another talk. In short, what I'm suggesting is that international events, many of which are related to migration and the circulation of ideas by immigrants, have created the grounds for changing domestic social policy discourses within the United States and within Mexico. But the comments that were made by President Fox and the debates over Mimin Pinguin in 2005 marked a particularly unusual and special year in the everyday workings of social policy debates in both countries. Perhaps for the first time since the Mexican Revolution, which ended in 1921, and at least for the first time since the 1960s, the issue of reconciling the African-American and black heritages in our international relations played a significant role in how we engage one another. Put in slightly different words, not since the U.S. civil rights movement has blackness emerged as a central issue in the bilateral conversations of each country. Now, importantly, the debates of 2005 were not critical ones. And there was actually an aftermath of 2005. You might remember that last year in Texas, Mimin Pinguin actually reared his ugly head again in kind of a Walmart scandal that arose. In any case, what I'm suggesting here is that, look, these issues, there's no one's life is at stake here. There are no sensitive binational policies that are being altered as a result of these debates. Instead, what these debates represent to me are a form of cultural war, with important victories being won on both sides. The most meaningful victory was that both countries have become more aware of each other's African heritage, and public discussions in Mexico have made the nation more conscious of its own African tradition. Now, it's far from common knowledge, but we're starting to learn more about this, but there are about roughly 1% of the current national population of Mexico can be considered Afro-Mexican. And at the time of the end of the colonial period, roughly 1810, the Afro-Mexican population comprised about 10% of the population, of the non-indigenous population. Now, despite some mistakes, I think both nations are learning better how to work with and respect each other's racial heritage. As our societies continue to converge, I think that many more of these types of debates, such as this Mimin Pinguin conflagration, many more of these types of cultural wars lie on the horizon, compelling all of us on both sides of the border to confront and to work through our different racial histories. Now, what is being left out of the conversation is a broader understanding of the long-standing shared history of race relations across the border, particularly with reference to blackness. Appreciating this history, I argue, is fundamentally important for at least two reasons. On the one hand, Latinos in the United States, while technically an ethnic group bearing more cultural than phenotypic significance, are not often treated or referenced as such by the average man on the street. Instead, Latinos and Hispanics have been racialized in our culture. Who hasn't heard in the course of everyday conversations someone speaking of Mexicans or quote-unquote Spanish peoples as races? Who hasn't read the headlines or seen the headlines where Latinos and Hispanics are analyzed monolithically without reference to differentiation between them, such as white, indigenous, mestizo, black, Hispanics, Latinos? Who hasn't seen articles where Latinos and Hispanics are juxtaposed and analyzed almost in racial lockstep with African Americans or other so-called races, such as Asian Americans and Native Americans? As Latinos get folded into the broader minority discourse of race in the United States, I believe that an appreciation of the shared history with African Americans specifically is illuminating for identifying and assessing certain structures of opportunity that may be closed to Latinos, some of which cannot be fully seen if the shared racialization processes that have operated on both African American and Hispanics are not fully understood. Secondly, an appreciation for the shared history between blacks and Hispanics is fundamental for coalition building. We are probably all aware that since the announcement in the summer of 2003, I remember I was sitting at my breakfast table sipping on Earl Grey tea when I read the headline, Latinos comprise the largest minority in the United States. the feelings of competitiveness between blacks and Hispanics seemed to intensify. You could feel it in the room. I was in North Carolina at the time, and it was remarkable what people were saying, and I will not repeat it. Some of this can be simply overcome by teaching about the ways in which our histories have intersected over historical periods. With these points in mind, I ask, as Mexico and the United States move forward in their relations with one another, what aspects of our common history regarding the African heritage are we overlooking that may sensitize us to our future interactions and that may improve our interrelations? Also, how has the United States-Mexican border been a vehicle for transporting black people and transmitting ideas about the black heritage? Before going into that further, there's actually another critical element to the puzzle that I think needs discussion, and that brings me to the title of the talk. On our side of the border especially, we cannot begin to understand fully how a new racial future is possible with our neighbors until we better understand some of the particularities of Mexico's unique and distinct racial history. Equally, there are many aspects of Mexico's racial past that Mexico itself has yet to acknowledge. Much of the oversight on both sides of the border stems from the fact that numerous elements of Mexico's racial heritage remain shrouded in the canvas of the archives. Until recently, scholars have not approached Mexican history with a critical framework for uncovering the full complexity of race relations. My goal with the rest of the talk is threefold. First, I want to provide you with some of my own recent findings and reflections on Mexico's racial legacy based on several years of research on the Mexican colonial caste system. Secondly, I want to use that history as a backdrop for better understanding what the United States-Mexican border has meant as a contact zone for African Americans and Mexicans. Finally, I want to close with some examination of Afro-Mexican migration to the United States. The combined effect of these three prongs of analysis will hopefully be to open up some new horizons and potentially some new fruitful arenas for engagement between the United States and Mexico and between African Americans and Mexican citizens in particular. First, let me begin with the caste system and how this has created a special environment for racial history in Mexico. Much of my most recent research has, as Dr. Haywood pointed out, has been focused on the studying the lives of what I call these forgotten castas, or the forgotten castes. Essentially, these were very esoteric categories within the Mexican colonial caste system, individuals known as lobos, moriscos, coyotes, and the like, who were somewhat equivalent to quadroons or octoroons or zambos here in the United States, but at the same time, they were quite different from any racial group that we are familiar with here in the U.S. I argue that the caste system has a bunch of anchors. There are a few groups that comprise the core. Español, white, Indio, Indian, Negro, Moreno, black, Mulatto, the mixture of black and white, Mestizo, the mixture of white and Indian, Pardo, the mixture of Indian and black, Morisco, white and Mulatto, Castizo, white and Mestizo. These are the core categories. Now, Morisco and Castizo have received very little scholarly attention, and I'm trying to recover that and a few more in my own project. Look, the caste system was all about managing whiteness and white privilege. And so what's interesting is that the native population was considered docile and assimilable in some ways. You could assimilate that particular population group. And in fact, continuous outmarrying, or what we call exogamy, of Indians or native mixtures with white individuals could actually produce a white person over three generations. Whereas if you look at the recipe with blackness, you know, after six generations of racial mixture continually with someone who is white, you end up with the no te entiendo in the caste system. I don't understand what you are, racial category. And this is the logic. We never actually got to that, at least in the documentation. But we do go pretty far down, and that's what I'm also trying to trace with this project. Now, what am I doing? I'm actually, with this project, I've been trying to conduct a social history for these groups, tracing their marriage patterns, their occupational trends, looking at their lives in the colonial courts and the Inquisition. And what I'm finding is fascinating, at least to me. Maybe it's only a historical fascination, as only a historian can appreciate. But in any case, While these groups probably never amounted to more than 2% of the population of Mexico, I have found that in the late 18th century, an inordinate amount of them were children, and that later in life, they probably switched their racial status at least once. Now, this phenomenon has helped me to theorize something that I call caste pluralism, meaning that over one's lifetime in colonial Mexico, it was not uncommon to live multiple caste or racial existences, especially if an individual was racially mixed. It was even possible, like I said, to kind of simultaneously represent oneself as mestizo or mulatto. Now, this caste pluralism, I argue, is something that is actually very different from the phenomenon of passing, which is something we might be familiar with, in that the switching of caste status was not always deliberate. It was not always done with an eye towards racial mobility. Sometimes, as one simply moved from one place to another, from one city to one month to a rural town in the next month, caste change could be grafted onto one's life according to local customs and how local customs interpreted one's phenotype and lineage. Among the other things that I'm discovering with this project is that despite the small number of forgotten castes, their impact as a social category was felt widely. These castes help define the very vocabulary of race by constituting the boundaries that marked the maximum reach of the core racial and caste categories. What am I saying? Moriscos, for instance, represented the extreme of what it meant to be a mulatto before crossing over into whiteness. The term can literally be translated as Moorish or Moor, and it held a host of negative connotations, reminding the largely Catholic society that these individuals looked like Moors and they may have had a historical Islamic heritage. Now, whether Moriscos were truly Moors or not, and truly by the 1680s, the majority of these so-called Moriscos really had no ties to Islam. What I'm trying to show is that this group served to mark the limit of social acceptability for white and black racial mixture. At the other extreme, the term lobo, which literally meant wolf, marked a similar boundary between the racial mixture between blacks and Indians. The many caste categories that existed in the Mexican caste system, combined with phenomena such as caste pluralism, meant that the system that we're talking about was something that was extremely fluid, and it grew increasingly more fluid over time. The colonial government actually engaged and promoted the situation by increasingly using caste and race in extremely fluid ways. By the late 18th century, it was clear that in its approach towards managing Mexico, the government aspired to maintain a few core caste groups intact, specifically the mulatto, español, mestizo, and indio. But it manipulated the use of other caste categories and racial categories to facilitate specific colonial projects, such as military recruitment efforts or tribute collection. In other words, what I'm saying is that when needed, the state voluntarily expanded the number of castes, multiplying the variations of blackness or Indianness, so as to capture the widest possible spectrum of the population of individuals into its net. And by these means, the black populations of the lightest shade, Moriscos, mulatos, blancos, which are white mulatos, and lobos, could fall prey to certain state projects and tax laws that included blacks, but that typically excluded whites. These efforts, of course, protected white privilege, which, again, was one of the major goals of the caste system, one could argue, by creating an ever-expanding buffer of intermediate categories before one actually landed in the realm of whiteness. Then, whenever it felt the need, the colonial government could contract the number of caste categories in order to bring order, quote-unquote, to Mexico's population. Now, this accordion approach to operating the caste system was effective in bureaucratic circles, but we are not completely sure how it affected the colonists. We can speculate that at times there was a wide disconnect between how the state saw matters of caste and race versus how the general population read them. I define this predicament as something called, or I call, the caste gap, in which there was sufficient latitude for the population to begin forming its own distinct racial codes of conduct, which resulted in the creation of alternate caste systems in various regions throughout Mexico. So therefore, what I'm arguing is that when you think about racial history in Mexico, the history of race and caste, and those two terms themselves are somewhat problematic to kind of align together, but I use them for the sake of argument here and hopefully be more easily digestible to this audience. When we think about the history of race and caste in Mexico, we must conceive of multiple subsidiary racial frameworks operating in tandem with, but still somewhat separate from the umbrella of the state. What is the larger significance of all of this? I argue that the result of everything that I've been describing, the calculated use by the colonial government of caste language, the racial mixture that took place over a period of generations, the phenomenon of caste pluralism, the creation of new caste terminologies, new caste systems within a system, all of this served as the root of something that we call Mexican mestizaje. One of the major tropes of Mexican history is the myth of mestizaje, which suggests that the nation is fundamentally one of mixed racial origins, deriving from interracial interactions beginning from the earliest colonial moments. The myth aspires to unify Mexico as one nation, since it claims that all races have an equal place in history, thanks to the nature of racial fusion. However, my research is leading me to believe that if one were to truly subscribe to the idea of mestizaje in its purest sense, quite a different picture of Mexican history can emerge. I believe that one of the underlying principles of mestizaje, continual racial mixture, actually leads to more racial heterogeneity rather than homogeneity, especially if we take into account the legacy of the Mexican caste system. I believe that it was only through conceptually readjusting mestizaje, conceptually adjusting mestizaje in ways that altered the history of Mexican caste, that a more homogenized view of history and racial mixture actually came into being. What do I mean by this? Consider that Mexico presents itself to the world as a mestizo nation, with a few Indians here and there, not as a nation of mulatos, mestizos, coyotes, lobos, moriscos, pardos, castizos, chinos, genizarros, various types of caste groups. Getting from the complexities of phenotype that existed in the colonial era to the relative evenness of race that we find in the 21st century had to come from somewhere. And I argue that it had much to do with mestizaje's treatment of its roots of the colonial Mexican caste system. Let's think about this for a second. The reason why we have the multiplicity of racial categories upon which mestizaje is based is because of the Mexican caste system. There would be no mestizos to speak of if it were not for the early colonial efforts to manage the ever-complex array of mixtures that directly challenged the government's authority and control. But at a certain point, rather than allow caste categories to expand and flourish infinitely and in an unwieldy fashion, the colonial government began to collapse and then compress these categories into smaller sets that it could manage. This is the accordion effect that I was describing earlier. Nowhere is this more clearly seen than in the census records of the colonial period. In the reams of pages that exist in the Mexican archives, these colonial censuses show us something interesting, that various strange and sometimes incomprehensible caste descriptions, a mulato alfrazado, I have no idea what that is, a morisco papayaste, who knows what that is, and the like, these particular terminologies that appear in the census record are flattened, and in the summary sheets that the government presented to Spain, all of these groups miraculously vanished. Moriscos, pardos, and lobos morphed into mulatos. Coyotes, albinos, and castizos morphed into mestizos. This homogenizing process that began in the colonial period continued into the early national period, creating the illusion of order that facilitated social management and control. The 20th and 21st century ideology of Mexican mestizaje is the direct inheritor of this process. But whereas the colonial government oscillated in between creating racial complexity and streamlining this complexity, the modern Mexican nation preferred to radically simplify racial diversity by emphasizing hybridity among groups. So that's something that kind of emerges. So that's where I am with some of this research. I'm really skating over and a very complex stuff, and trying to serve it up to you in a somewhat somewhat digestible fashion. Now, what's fascinating about for the history of the United States-Mexican border, with this particular history, if we carry this story into the story of the U.S.-Mexican border, and to U.S.-Mexican race relations more generally, what we find is that while Mexico was wrestling with the legacy of its own caste system and began articulating early versions of mestizaje, gradually between the period of 1820s to the 1890s, and then more with more rapidity in the early 1900s, the nation's outlook actually began to fundamentally change in its attitudes towards blackness. During the 1930s, Mexico invested heavily in its tourist industry, developing particularly highway infrastructure, hotel and airline industries. World War II also changed the nature of tourism from the United States into Mexico, and actually the tourism of the United States in general. The war almost eliminated American travel to Europe. Instead, Mexico, Canada, and the Caribbean became primary destinations. By 1939, roughly 1,000 Americans were visiting Mexico per month. The 1940s and 50s also saw great increases in the wealth of African Americans in a relative sense, in that between the 1940s and 1960, African American wealth increased by 20% every 5 years. And in 1949, there was a collapse of the Mexican peso. You might be able to see what I'm getting at here. There was a perfect storm of factors. Highway or tourist industry created a war that changes the nature of tourism, wealth in African American pockets as they'd never seen before. The Jim Crow refugees that started to enter Mexico, that entered Mexico in the late 19th and 20th centuries, started to change their class position and class status. These individuals now arriving in Mexico, African Americans, once Mexico opened its gates again, were very different. These were businessmen. They were professionals. They were artists, painters, boxers. They were people who came to Mexico through an African-American tourist agency that opened in Mexico City called William and Martin's Tours. This was a talented tent in some ways. And it changed, in some ways, the look of blackness in Mexico and some of the conversations that existed. I did a biography of a guy named Virgil Richardson, and he was part of this wave of African Americans coming in the post 1930s into the 1940s and 50s. This particular golden age of African American immigration, I argue, kind of ends in the mid 1960s, just as civil rights starts to kind of percolate and as Americans start to gain, African Americans start to beginning to gain more liberties. Virgil Richardson, I bring to the table because he was a World War II hero, flew 62 combat missions. He was someone who was wounded in the heat of war. He was an incredibly brilliant man. He was the son-in-law of Hubert Harrison, a Harlem radical. He married Ada Harrison, who was Hubert Harrison's daughter. He was a co-founder of the American Negro Theater, and after World War II, came back to the United States and found himself in the predicament that many soldiers, black soldiers, found themselves in. And that was the situation of losing the double V, the double victory. The war that was being fought abroad did not translate into success at home. And he was arrested several times for driving while black. And he happens to be in California. He's pulled over. He has nothing in his car but a skillet and drives across the border to Mexico, furious at his treatment, and had no plans, drives to Tijuana, continues driving south, makes it to Acapulco eventually, and calls Mexico home for the next 50 years. This story is not an atypical one. It is not one that involves huge numbers, but there are people who are doing this, not just in Mexico, they're doing it in other parts of Latin America, specifically in Haiti. We find an African-American GI actually opening up one of the early dry cleaning industries in Haiti, becomes a successful entrepreneur. So these are interesting stories of diaspora and transnationalism. What's interesting is that as this guy recreates his life in the United States, in Mexico, he ends up buying an apartment that is located just a couple blocks away from the U.S. Embassy. And what's fascinating is that he becomes kind of a new gateway in and of his own right. By the mid-1950s, if you're going to Mexico, you have to make an obligatory stop by Virgil Richardson's house for one of his rumored famous parties. He becomes kind of a gatekeeper for reinterpreting the American, not necessarily African-American, but American expatriate experience in Mexico. Fascinating story, fascinating life. I write about this particular episode of African-American migration to Mexico as something that creates a different look of African-Americanness and blackness itself. African-Americans, and indeed Africans, because they're Ghanaians who are also coming in at this time as well, become something I call super black. They transcend kind of the normal strictures of blackness, especially in a Jim Crow America. Now, this super black status is something that I think is perhaps no better embodied than this guy here, John Clytus. John Clytus, another GI who goes to Mexico, and literally months before this picture was taken, this was a guy living on park benches, sleeping in movie theaters, was an itinerant worker in California, and decided one day to go to Mexico to learn Spanish. And here he is seen months after living like this, you know, in fencing class, you're looking eye to eye with white Americans at Mexico City College. Look at that pose. I mean, that pose is the ultimate kind of manifestation of confidence if I've ever seen it. This is kind of what it means to be super black. Again, this ultimate transformation of self, using minimal wealth translating to maximum social status and cachet. I actually ran across this picture by accident and later picked up the book that this guy ended up writing. He went from Mexico to Cuba after he learned some Spanish and ended up writing his book, Black Man in Red Cuba, which is a fascinating critique of Castro Cuba from a black perspective. So here he's seen in Mexico in this transformative mode and gives him a new horizon and confidence in order to express himself when he goes to Cuba. Fascinating story. Where have we come from? We've looked at the Mexican caste system. We've talked about modern race relations. And we've looked at how the caste system translates into new, was appropriated and reworked into this myth of mestizaje. And also, while that myth was being massaged, African Americans are coming into Mexico across the border. They are experiencing blackness in a way that's different than the way the government is promoting their blackness, because the government is hijacking African American and foreign blackness to supplant and replace native African, Afro-Mexican blackness. But as that's happening in this dialectic, what's interesting is that African Americans are recreating themselves and writing a new narrative from themselves that's different from Jim Crow. The border becomes the space, becomes the demarcator, if you will, of this process. Now, today, Afro-Mexicans are coming to the United States. What you see in this map are the locations of the primary Afro-Mexican communities. And towards the bottom of the map, in a shaded area that's shaded gray, you are looking at a region of Mexico known as the Costa Chica, or the Little Coast, and where arguably the largest Afro-Mexican population exists. People think it's Veracruz, but Veracruz is a different population. It's a population that's heavily influenced by the Caribbean. In this West Coast area, the population has had fewer influences from outside and have deeper links to the colonial period, in part because of relative isolation. These are parts of the world that, in fact, the Costa Chica did not get its first highway system until the 1960s. These are places that have kind of been frozen in time and forgotten in the Mexican imaginary, and purposely so. Because the government didn't necessarily want these areas to kind of emerge on the landscape as black regions. But what's interesting now is that peoples from these areas are migrating to the United States, particularly Chicago, California, and North Carolina, which is where I've done a little bit of work, specifically in the town of Winston-Salem. This is a town, and North Carolina in general has been one of the fastest growing Latino populations in the United States. 500% increase in Latinos from 1990, 6 to 7% of the population is Latino. And in Winston-Salem, a very high proportion, in fact, some would argue 80% of the Latino population there are from the Costa Chica. At least this is what is said. Now, no one's actually gone through and done the work. this is what we hear. Someone needs to go through and actually do the census work. Or or maybe not. You can't. These are figures that are hard. These are slippery figures to get your hands on for obvious reasons. The first to a person from the Costa Chica to arrive in North Carolina was this guy here, Viterbo Calleja Garcia, who was seen here dancing with friends. Arrived in 1978 and supposedly went to North Carolina. He originally went to Texas, but the coyote or the guide who helped him get across the border said, look, man, you know, you can do much better in North Carolina. Better climate, it's more closer to home in terms of climate, better wages. So the guy tried it and went back and forth between 1978 and the mid-1980s, finally bringing his family up from Mexico and finally settled in the United States permanently and resides legally here now. Was making $3.35 an hour and now doing far better than that. What's interesting is how the areas where Afro-Mexicans are settling are at least in this part of the South, the New South, as it's being cooked up, is that they are moving to areas that have that are traditionally African-American. And so they're moving into two communities in particular, one called Lakeside, the other Wowtown. Some culture wars have been taking place. And what's interesting is that what I did with my anthropologist friend was to look at a few businesses to see what was going on in a few strip malls, and we visited a few bodegas and local stores, and particularly see what's interesting here is this kind of branding of the Costa Chica identity in this Costa Chica mini market. So there's this kind of effort to replicate space and place to make the horizons and the landscape of North Carolina familiar in ways by kind of marking territory through stores and other ways. Some of these culture wars are taking place between African Americans and Afro-Mexicans are taking place in these strip malls where Afro-Mexican businesses are moving in and supplanting African American businesses. There are a couple of things. African Americans do interact in positive ways with the Latino population and the Afro-Mexican population, sometimes intermarrying, as this woman here, Sherry Peoples, has intermarried and having a child with an Afro-Mexican. She's shopping at Titi's convenience store here in Winston-Salem. Again, this is not my picture. This is actually a journalist's picture, much better than what I could do. There are moments and episodes of disconnect, and that takes place usually during the church hour. The Catholicism of the Afro-Mexican community is juxtaposed against the Protestantism, the intense devout Baptist roots of many African Americans in this part of the world, and so a lot of community building is done in churches, especially amongst the Black community. And when the African American community, let me rephrase, and when that doesn't happen, when those spaces are different, possibilities for community building are lost. And unfortunately, there's been a rise in gang activity. African Americans have learned that, especially African American gangbangers have learned that the Latino population often do not use banks and keep a lot of wealth on person, especially under their mattresses and in their homes and cans, etc. And so that has led to a predatory kind of African-American gang approach upon some of the Afro-Mexican community. And the Afro-Mexican community has responded in kind with their own gangs. The MS-13 symbol here, a notorious gang. These are outfits. You don't want to mess with MS-13 or Amara Salvatrucha or some of these other very, very dangerous gangs that have sometimes paramilitary training. There's a new gangland going on, and these are some problems that we're going to be facing in years to come, I think, in our interrelations with one another. But I think the future looks bright with the children. And in this particular part of the world, teachers, in fact, have taken it upon themselves to create moments, to create celebrations, to create festivals in which African Americans and the local Latino communities share their heritages. And so what you're seeing is a picture of a school pageant, one of many that happened at this particular school in Winston-Salem. You also see here children laughing, African-American girl with the daughter of Viterbo Calleja, that first migrant from the Costa Chica to Winston-Salem. And they're laughing at themselves dancing salsa a few years earlier, and they're watching a videotape of themselves. You can't believe how bad she's dancing. These are the moments, right? This is where some of the future directions might be. And in the final outtake, an African American boy, his name escapes me, with a young Afro Mexican, looking at what they're looking at is a soccer ball that's been kicked up into a tree, and so soccer is becoming something that is being embraced in some ways by some African Americans. So. What I've tried to do today is to kind of explore multiple dimensions of a complex relationship. I've tried to situate for you a history of caste within a broader story of an evolving set of relations, of interactions that lie on the horizon as new cultural wars exist in this new era, the 21st century brand of culture wars. These are multiculturalism and political correctness were the culture wars of the 80s. The culture wars of the 21st century are involving kind of multiculturalism on steroids, right, in a way. And so that we are now looking at what the possibilities are when post-political correctness has played itself out, where identity formation has sedimented communities such as the Latino community, Hispanic community, and how those rub against traditional African-American communities. This is what lies on the horizon. Thank you so much for your attention.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program and Latin American Studies Program. Speaking was Dr. Ben Vinson, Director of the Center for Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Vinson's lecture was titled Caste in Mexico. He was introduced by Professor Linda Haywood, Director of the African American Studies Program. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Jared Mooney and Edward Mazulis. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.